Welcome to the Youth Speaks Out podcast for November 2017. This edition features interviews from Laytonville High School. In the first one, Eve interviews Principal Tim Henry about the role and perspective of a high school administrator. In the second interview, Tim Skaggs talks with Dennis Hogan, the math and rock band teacher. They discuss his 30-year teaching vocation and his 40-year rock musician avocation. The link to automatically receive our podcast is available at our website, youthspeaksout.net.
Hello, welcome to Youth Speaks Out podcast. I'm Eve Crowling, and I'm a sophomore at Laytonville High School. I'm here joined today by our principal, Tim Henry.
Hi, Eve.
Hi. I want to start off by asking, what's the role of the principal, Like, what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
I think that that's going to differ depending on what type of high school or how big of a high school. If, you know, the high school where I attended, 2,000 students, you had, you know, a principal and assistant principals, and some were focused on curriculum and some were focused on behavior, and some were focused on staffing. And, you know, there was a lot of division of labor. And in this county and in many of the small schools, the simple answer is everything, all duties as necessary. I don't have an exact breakdown of how my time is spent, but it's split between curriculum and instruction development, working directly with teachers on instruction, working with the community, and that might be, you know, talking to parents in the parking lot, or it might be site council, where we make all sorts of decisions on behalf of the school and the student body. It might be figuring out ways to improve attendance, how to incentivize better performance amongst our students. And of course, as many might expect, a chunk of time is spent on discipline as well.
You mentioned working with teachers, and as I might say, used to be a teacher. And so how do you...
I used to be your teacher.
Used to be my teacher up at
Starting at kindergarten. Little
Spy Rock up there. What are some of the contrast of being a teacher compared to being a principal, and how can you learn from what you did as a teacher into you being a principal?
There's quite a few contrasts and obviously quite a few similarities. I think that the similarities include working with students, and that's, I think, what binds us all together. And we often ask the question, especially in our staff meetings and when we're discussing these matters, is, you know, what can we do for our students? How can we better prepare them? And I think that really gets down to the essence and the purpose of high school is, you know, we can take pride on our students based on how they perform out in the world, whether that's, you know, in their careers or in their, you know, in college, or how they become community contributors. The differences probably have to do with, you know, the administrative duties and looking at things from maybe a legalistic perspective sometimes, getting a little bit more perspective and trying to make decisions that keep, like, the entire student body safe, or that put us on a track towards progress. And so there's a little less direct dealings with students and a little more direct dealing with adults and staffing. And that's, I think that's where the big difference comes. And when you're a teacher, you really are focused on what's happening with the classroom, and your focus is very much on the individual students in your classroom and how you can improve the instruction, you know, what kind of programs you can give to them. And I think as a principal or an administrator, you're taking a wider perspective, and you're looking at the whole picture.
Do you miss anything about being a teacher, like the hands-on cooperation with students, or?
Yeah, I definitely miss the direct instruction. I miss the discussion. seeing the progress of individual students throughout the year, or in the case of Spyrock, between the ages of kindergarten and fifth grade or sixth grade. I miss teaching PE. I miss, doing curriculum research. I miss the hands-on project-based learning that was the focus of my instruction as a teacher.
Well, since this is such a small school, do you recognize any advantages / disadvantages of going to a small school compared to a bigger one?
I think there's both. You know, like I said before, coming from I think my graduating class was somewhere around 800, and there's, a certain degree of anonymity there. That has its pluses and minuses too. You can always make new friends and reinvent yourself. And in a large high school, there's lots of programs. There's not just a calculus class, but there's going to be advanced placement calculus. There's not just a building trades class, but there's going to be, different kinds of wood shops, and there's metal shop and an auto, so there's a lot more options at a larger school, just in terms of every student is going to be able to find something that is going to be appealing to them. On the other side of it, it's very easy in a large school like that to slip through the cracks. And one of the things that our staff prides themselves in here at Laytonville High School is that even if students want to fall through the cracks, we don't let them. we definitely keep close tabs on where students are academically and emotionally and otherwise. And if we see something happening, we definitely step in and, share time in our staff meetings every week to share any student concerns and have a formal process to step in and find a way to help students.
Wow, I think that's good. Do you think graduating from a small town has any, a small town high school, has any effect on a student getting into college?
No.
No?
No.
Not at all?
I really think that if students, and I've seen this, in my time living in Laytonville, is that if a student takes advantage of everything this high school has to offer and everything that this community and the community of Laytonville has to offer, they can go anywhere and do anything. That's not going to be what holds a student back. I also think that colleges have admission processes in place that takes into account, whether they've come from a large school and what they have, what they're able to take advantage of, or versus students who come from a small school and they've done everything that they can in their school and they've taken every academic class possible. So, we've had students go to Berkeley and all kinds of state colleges. When it's all said and done, I think that our students can still be very competitive. And now, I think what's changed, especially in the last, say, 5, if not 10 years, is that more and more students are taking community college classes while they're in high school. So you not only have all the classes that are available at the high school, but we also take an active role in providing books and support and enrolling in community college classes. In our case, it's specific with Mendocino College because we have, we have certain partnerships with them. So that whatever they're offering, our students can take, as long as there's no prerequisite that they are supposed to have beforehand. And we do support them in that through providing books for them through the college. And, it's virtually free for them.
Yeah, as a student, I think that's very useful because it was my scheduling. I had to get foreign language credits in there, and I'm taking it at the college currently. And those books are expensive. Mine was $140. So
yeah, our superintendent is, very forward thinking in that manner, and she made sure that in our plan and our budget that was set.
Mm-hmm. Now you said that any class at Mendocino College is available to us high school students without needed a prerequisite. And
Providing it's available with your schedule.
With the schedule.
I mean, obviously, if it's a Monday through Friday and you know, it's going to take up a chunk of your day, that creates some problems there. A lot of students are, I'm sorry to cut you off, but a lot of students are taking their classes online.
Yeah, I was just going to mention online classes. Yeah, so
that's really big. Some students do take some night courses, but a lot of students are taking classes that they can attend online. And then if there's gaps in their day, they can come to our library for our study skills class, where they can grab a Chromebook and log into their class during their, you know, quote, free periods. They can be attending their college classes.
Wow.
Provides for a lot of flexibility.
Now, since we're talking so much about college, I want to ask, how or why did you become, like, interested in being in the educational career? Did you set it off to be that in college, or did you decide later on?
For me, it's a vocation. I've always been working with children. You know, my mom had a daycare in her home growing up, and so I had a lot of responsibilities helping her with the daycare and then working at camps and after-school programs. It always appealed to me, and I wanted to do something in my life that made a difference. And so it's important to take care of our world, our planet, our communities. And so I think for that reason, working directly with the youth is probably the most important thing that we can do, because it's our future. You know, we eventually die, and the next generation is what carries on. And so I have a lot of interests in life and a lot of directions that I, you know, have dreamed about going, you know, from politics to law to being an apple farmer. But ultimately, I know I can still dabble in those things, and ultimately, I can still work with the youth and have involvement in that way. So it was a vocational choice. It was something that I was drawn to and always have been, and it's very fulfilling.
What is something you wish that we could offer here at Laytonville that we can't? Like, what's something you think high schoolers should learn, but that's not regularly taught in schools?
That's a great question. You know, I came from an elementary background. This is my fifth year as principal here at Laytonville High School. I taught for 11 years before that at Spyrock Elementary School, where you were my student. So when I did get here, one of the things that I realized is that there was this whole world of career technical education, CTE. I think that we do really well for our students in them obtaining their A through G certification, and those are the classes required for students to get into colleges. Everything from English to the histories to the advanced mathematics and advanced sciences, the arts and the language. And then there's the world of career technical education, which is really one of the inspiring things in high school education. In the old days, I think it was called ROP, like when I was going to high school. So each of these, you know, we have different CTE pathways, and these are really classes that speak to a lot of students, because, you know, they have some vocational interests. They can be directly applied to the career realm, and a lot of students are very interested in them. Currently here, we have 5 career pathways. We have our emergency response pathway, which includes like the emergency response class and our fire department class. We have culinary arts, which is culinary arts 1 and 2. And, you know, those students, that's articulated with Mendocino College. And those students are, you know, pretty excited. I think you're in culinary arts 2, right?
I am, yeah.
So they get to get some cooking experience. We have a building trades pathway which is dual enrollment through Mendocino College. We have our computer technology pathway, and then we have our art pathway, which is a marketing and design and arts. In an ideal world, I think I'd really love to expand the career pathways. We have 1 ag science class that's taught by Mr. Potter, it's a single class and it's not technically a career pathway, but we'd like to, I would love to expand that. Looking at the future of Mendocino County and our communities, they're changing. And, you know, when we're looking at tourism and agriculture and building and, you know, really doing things that can build our communities up. If students are inclined to go to college, that's fantastic. And we want to support that. And I know a lot of rural communities are really trying to figure out the, you know, balance between doing the very best for their students without having an absolute brain drain in rural communities going directly to the urban centers. And I think that there will probably be more and more of a balance there with as more people do telecommuting and live in communities like this. But having more vocational training, more CTE pathways in our communities, whether it's Laytonville or Round Valley or Willits or Mendocino or Potter Valley, all of them, is going to really be what helps to build our county up and diversify our economy. So I think that high schools really can play a vital role in that. And one of the things that can help out with that is finding teachers and instructors who are able to teach these vocational pathways, because that's obviously a big deal, bringing in people who are willing to teach and get their CTE credentials. Maybe even if they're just teaching that class one or two periods a day, it's a great way to give back to your community and give back to the students and turn some people on to whatever your vocation is, and at the same time get paid a little bit for it.
Yeah, that's great. And since we're talking about like job preparation in high school, I know that we do have like a program where if students have a job, they can take periods out of their day. Am I getting this right?
So there's two realms. And one is called work experience, and one is called community classroom. And the work experience is for students who choose to have a job that, you know, pertains to their area of studies, and they work in that and then do write-ups and turn that in. And then there's community classroom, where students who have an interest in a particular field actually have sort of like a mentor situation, and they work with those, you know, in a maybe a business or with a, you know, an organization, and do some write-ups and, you know, share out their experiences and get credits in return for that. So, you know, currently we have students working for, you know, the automotive sector, the health field at the Long Valley Health Clinic. Students have historically worked, you know, maybe in food preparation or perhaps bank, or, you know, you could all those different realms. And so, you know, that is something that one of our teachers, Sue Carberry, has, you know, helped to nurture over the years. And other people are finding ways to plug in and help that program get stronger and grow.
I think a lot of people value hands-on, like, experience learning, which is what a lot of schools are moving forward to now. It's less like book and like read this and then answer the questions. And I feel that
right. So the Common Core curriculum, which has, you know, pretty much washed over the whole United States, has, you know, some things about it that are really amazing. And one of which is the whole idea that experiential learning and, you know, discussion, students working together, you know, in an exploratory way, is in problem solving, is really like kind of the ideology behind it, and you know, working out of a book and doing question and answer, and you know, that's kind of, you know, a little more simple in terms of like obtaining information, you know, as I think.
But a lot of students don't obtain, at least in my experience, a lot of people don't obtain the information from that type of learning. So
yeah, and you know, given the problems that we face as a society, as a planet, I think that we're really going to have to think outside of the box. And so the whole concept of project-based learning and critical thinking is going to be vital to the future existence of the human race and many of the other species that we share this planet on and depend on. You know, just look at agriculture and the, you know, the problems that we're going to have to overcome, and just in order to feed people, whether it's like seed stock or soil health or, you know, the managing changing climate. I mean, those are all things that we're going to have to come up with solutions for. And I think, was it Einstein who said that, like, you know, it's like you can't really solve problems by the same thinking that created them. So this new movement within education, and, you know, some people, you know, have some criticisms of the Common Core curriculum, but if you boil it down to the essence of we need to prepare our students to adapt to the, you know, to our changing world and to be critical thinkers and to be problem solvers, I think that we can all agree that that's going to, in theory, be a really good thing for the future of humanity.
Do you think that every high school graduate should have at least one skill that will give them a living wage job?
Why not?
Is high school providing that right now? Is the average person that's graduating from high school?
Is this a trick question, Dan?
No, to me, it's an important question because it used to be when I went to high school that part of the idea was by the time you got through high school, you'd have a skill that you could actually go and make a living with. Overall, that was true.
Right, and it seems
now that it's much more oriented towards college prep. Towards preparing people to go to college. Is that?
Well, I think that, you know, part of that might even be because the colleges are, you know, involved in the vocational realm more than ever, especially the community colleges. And, you know, I think like many schools, we support students in going to 4-year universities if they've met the requirements for that and that's what they choose. But we're really giving a lot of focus and attention to students attending community colleges. Should every student have a trade or have a, you know, skills that make them a living wage right outside of school? I'd say, yeah, of course. And the very first thing that I think, you know, all students should have are good speaking and listening skills. Because in a world and an economy and a global economy that's based on information, like the first two things that we all need to be good at is speaking and listening, because that's what's going to give us the cues about, you know, how to take the next steps towards making a living. Anybody who stands by in a passive way and kind of lets the world direct them into some kind of career, you know, there definitely could be issues there. I think that really, like, I would encourage students, and I do encourage mine, to take the bull by the horns and, like, really explore what they want to do and to find a vocation that's inspiring to them, something they can be really good at and, you know, something hopefully that makes them a living income or a living wage, I think is what you said, which is something that I think is, you know, a little more difficult than it was when you graduated from high school, for sure.
It's even more difficult than when you graduated from high school, I would say.
Yeah, for sure. Exponentially.
I think, yeah. And that CTE, I mean, that is kind of what that's doing. It's career tracking.
Right.
You know,
right.
If somebody learns enough about foods and food preparations, then they actually have the ability to go and become, you know, apprentice at a restaurant or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just as a few examples, our Culinary Arts 2 class just took a trip up to the Benbow Inn a week and a half ago. And they spent a whole day up there talking to the management. I mean, they do, you know, Benbow, for instance, as our CTE director was telling me, hires employees through like a foreign visa. So they're having to hire people from out of the country to work for them in this hospitality and tourism through a hospitality and tourism visa. And these students are really excited about the, for instance, the kind of food that they're making there and the kind of, you know, jobs that they're doing. And like, hey, look, here's something right in our little region, you know, that these students can plug into to make a decent living. You know, art students going down to the community college and to the museums to check things out. I mean, so one of the things is that we're having these exploratory field trips based on these particular careers. I know that our emergency response pathway through our fire department class and our emergency response class, you know, is constantly taking field trips and looking at like what CAL FIRE is doing and, you know, checking out their stations and offering certifications that, you know, can help students into those emergency response fields. And that's something that is, even in our community, like there's some, you know, really some decent fair wage livings can be made, you know, doing those things. And they provide a huge contribution to our safety and to, you know, many other things in our community.
I just want to say, having gone on both of those trips you described, it was really interesting, especially the Bembo one. We learned like all about hospitality, and we talked to the maid dude for, I want to say, a long time, but everything he was saying was very interesting.
Yeah.
On how it's more of the hospitality business is more of a community than a kind of, I don't want to say like hierarchy business. So.
Yeah. And I can just say from personal experience, you know, I've lived here a little while now, and I definitely see people exploring the ideas of what is next stage in the economy and the kind of jobs people are going to get into here in Mendocino County, and particularly the rural areas of Mendocino County. I know I was really inspired in my travels in, say, British Columbia and Quebec as well, with their agritourism industry. You know, where you have these individual, you know, farms that are providing value-added items, and you have the counties or the, you know, some of the tourism information places that are providing maps of, you know, going to these different farms and trying these cheeses or these ciders, or, you know, being able to go to these bakeries and these. Is that this, we live in an amazing place. It is like, it is so beautiful here, and we have clean air and clean water and beautiful forests and a lot of biological diversity. And from our very early history to our indigenous history to the Back to the Land movement, there's a lot of very interesting people here with a lot of diverse skills. We really have something to offer to the world. Coming from someone who chose to live here, like I really believe that. And I think that tapping into, you know, our potential as a county and as you know, our bioregion, like we can really capitalize on that and raise the vitality, the economic vitality and the pride in the place where we live.
Well, I'm Eve Kreiling. I'm a sophomore at Laneville High School, and I've been talking with Mr. Tim Henry, our principal.
Thank you, Eve. Great job.
You are listening to the U Speaks Out podcast featuring students and staff from Laytonville, California High School.
Hi, my name is Tim Skaggs, and right now I'm a musician, and right now I'm interviewing my music teacher, Dennis Hogan. Also, some of my latest electronic music was inspired by his band, the Tasmanian Devils. By the way, the song Showdown, I think it's a great song, and played a huge role in that one song I made called Rock Band, which was also inspired by the Laytonville High School Rock Band. So, Mr. Hogan, what exactly drew you into music?
I was always interested in songs from as early as I can remember. I guess my mom sang to me, my older sister sang to me or something, but I just started singing.
Same.
And never stopped.
So describe your musical career.
The first time I got on stage, I was 3 years old. And I sang a little song. There was a little neighborhood production. And I guess I was singing to my little friends or whatnot, and the older kids heard me and said, well, Dennis, you're going to get up on stage. And, you know, a little neighborhood thing. And I remember I got up and sang my little song. And when I got off that stage and the other little kids got up and did what we're doing, I wanted back on that stage. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was hooked from then on. Had little groups when I was a kid, little folk groups. Started playing guitar at age 9. We all listened to a group called the Kingston Trio, and then we had a group called the Princeton Trio. Did kind of calypso and stuff like that. I guess I started listening to rock and roll at about age 10 or 11 or something, and I think when the Beatles, I started listening to the Beatles and I decided I wanted to be a rock and roll musician. So I got some of my friends together and taught a couple of them how to play. And we got a band together and started playing around. And by the time we were seniors, we won the KFRC Battle of the Bands for North Bay, Marin and Sonoma counties. That was pretty good, I guess, you know. Went to college, used San Diego, started a band down there. And then decided to leave school and went to Europe, played music, played on the streets of, I lived in Norway, but I'd go to Copenhagen and Amsterdam and Oslo, London, play, you know, just busking, you know, they call it over there. And I tried to get a record deal there in England, and didn't get anything. Came back here, finished college, and when I finished college, I got together with some of my high school friends, and we started the Tasmanians, and played around the Bay Area for a few years, got signed with Warner Brothers, and did those couple of albums with them. Had a hit in England. Funny. And then, you know, I think the music business was not for me. I had a daughter at that time, and I wanted to be with her rather than touring. You know, I found that it was just not what I really wanted to do. It was a pretty stressful business, really. So went back to school, became a teacher, and here I am.
Yep, here you are. And if I'm not mistaken, you're actually back with the Tasmanian Devils now, and you guys still play sometimes.
Well, yeah, we've never stopped being friends.
Oh, yeah.
You know, of the five original members, four of us still play together. One guy lives up in Idaho, but the four of us who are still playing were all friends in high school. Not necessarily in the same band, but the lead guitar player and I met when we were in high school and started playing together. And we've written quite a few of the songs that when you mentioned Showdown, Dave writes music and then I come up with words and vocals.
Describe your teaching career in music and math. Like, how's it going? How do you like it here?
Well, I'm really credentialed to teach math and science, but I've been a math teacher here in Laytonville. And I don't know how it started. I think I just naturally gravitate toward playing music and toward kids who play music. I think when my first year at the high school, there was a little group that used to practice at lunch. They'd play and whatnot, and they were pretty good. And one day they were playing a Hendrix song. They were playing Hey Joe. And I was listening. I was talking to the principal and listening out in the hall, and suddenly I heard a wrong note. And I thought, oh, my, wow, that's weird. So I went in and said, hey, that one part is not right. Showed them how to play it. And then they wanted me to sing with them or something. And that was the first year I was at the high school. And we did a couple of little things, you know. And after that, my friend Paula at the time, Paula Mulligan, was the English teacher. She's my friend and neighbor. And then we taught a couple of classes together that was more rock-oriented. I guess I think I taught a middle school class, maybe middle school music class, and, you know, it was more rock-oriented. And then over the years, you know, the kids who wanted to play music would just say, hey, you know, we really want to play. I mean, sometimes we'd have to... There wouldn't be necessarily a rock band class. We'd meet at lunch or after school or something. And And then finally, when Mrs. Potter became the principal, I think she actually formalized the rock band class. And that would have been, gosh, almost 20 years ago now, actually. Yeah. So, and after that, there's been a rock band class every year, and now two rock band classes and a middle school class. And we're very fortunate to be supported by the Bill Graham Foundation. And one of the board members of the Bill Graham Foundation puts on the shows up here, the Kate Wolf, and puts on the shows out at the Hog Farm. And so he obviously seen that you guys play and really appreciates what you do and makes sure that you have everything you need to make the music that you want to make.
Indeed, which includes getting the keys in the right order with the right rhythm.
Correct. Well, that's true. Have to do that.
Yep. So basically in high school, you were inspired by music that other people were doing and also by bands like the Beatles, right?
Yeah, I think it started with the Beatles. Well, it started before that, but I think I saw that, you know, young guys could get together with a couple of guitars and have a band and sing and play music. I think before that, you know, even the rock and roll days, it was fairly produced. You know, they'd have a producer and they'd hire musicians and they'd have a singer and that would be the song. But then in high school, you know, listening to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and whoever else, they were copying American music, which we would call, it was even in those days called rhythm and blues, but it was African-American music. Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, you know, John Lee Hooker, you know, and then going way back into the acoustic, it would be Robert Johnson, people like that. And that was who influenced them. And so even when I was in high school, I started buying those albums and realized, boy, now that's the real sound. And so ultimately, I would say that I was very influenced by rhythm and blues and then later gospel music.
So your high school offered a music program?
Yeah, I went to a large high school in Marin County. But the music class, music classes, really, they had a vocal, they had a marching band, they had a jazz band, and they had a chorus, they called. But I was a singer, guitar player, you know, and there wasn't, you know, even in the jazz class, I don't even think there was a guitar. They didn't have a guitarist in the jazz class. Yeah, they have saxes. It was saxophone. It was a big band, what you call big band music. I guess I have sung in choirs or choruses and things, but I was kind of a, to be honest with you, I was kind of a math science student when I was in high school, and I played music for myself every day, but it wasn't the music that was offered at the high school wasn't the music that I was listening to.
Okay, that would make sense then. Usually you're good at something if you really like it. So the music program you have here, this is a daily class?
I work 2 days a week. I do my math classes in block periods, but we meet as a rock band 2 days a week. And I found that we can get everything done that we need to get done in two rehearsals a week. It requires focus, and it requires you guys to go home and practice. So it meets 2 days a week, basically, and, you know, we get ready, do various shows. We do, first show is Homecoming, which is usually in October, and then we do a winter concert, and then we do a variety of concerts in the spring. Go to Mendocino High School, play at the elementary school, probably play up at Benbow Arts Festival, play at graduation.
Oh, yeah, that's right. What would you say is your method for teaching?
For beginning students, I would say I had a sort of a repertoire of easy guitar rock type songs, surf music, songs that are easy to play. The thing about rock and roll is I think of it as a kind of a folk music. And I think folk music, if you define it as a music that is played by maybe untrained people. In other words, I don't think rock musicians have necessarily gone to Berklee School of Music or something like that. And a lot of it's learned by ear, or you watch somebody play. That's how I learned. I'd go to shows, I'd sit in the front row, and I'd watch the guitar player. So I think of it as folk music. And so folk music is actually doable. You don't have to be a great musician, hugely skilled, to be able to sound pretty good. So I start out with that in mind, showing easy, simple songs. How do you play a blues pattern? You know, how do you put your fingers? How do you play this chord? How do you play that chord? I work with the drummers quite a bit. I'm not a drummer myself, but I played with great drummers, and I know what they do. And after that, what I try to do is to get you guys, the kids, to bring in songs that they like or you like, because it's your music that you're playing now, you know. And I've actually learned a lot about rock and modern rock and even old rock that I didn't think I was necessarily that interested in by you guys bringing songs in. So what we do is we pick a day and everybody brings in something on their phone or their computer and we play it through the big system and then we have a process of deciding which couple of songs we're going to focus on. And then I usually try to write charts, which is like sort of like written music, but it's basically what are the chords, you know, what are the changes, yeah, you know, what's a basic riff, you know, what is the guitar player basically doing that you hear a riff is like, you know, the signature line in the melody or the opening of satisfaction, you'd call that a riff. And then, you know, have you guys listen, have you guys practice, have this, you have to make sure that the singers can sing the song. If the singers can't sing the song, you can't do it because, you know, a song is about singers and the band backs the singers up. And so, you know, I like it because by the time you guys get good, it's kid generated material. I don't generate the material unless nobody can come up with any ideas.
Right, like the song "Paint It Black." That was your decision, and
right, that'd be like an easy song that people who don't know how to play. For example, you were in a class with a couple of beginners, right? You already knew how to play, so I had you play the keyboard part. Right. So that was new for you.
It was.
And, you know, the other kids could play, and it sounds pretty much like, you know, "Paint It Black," you know.
That's my favorite one that we're doing right now. So basically, your students perform first at homecoming, mm-hmm. Then in the band room in front of an audience,
right,
and then in various different locations, also at open house for freshman orientation.
Right.
And also we perform in the band room almost every class.
Every class, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unless we're doing something different, like
right, listening to songs or something,
putting equipment back or loading it up. So, is there anything you would change about high school to make it more efficient?
High school in general?
Yeah.
You know, my whole career, I've always sort of believed in what you would call project-based learning. you learn by doing something, and then when you have a need to know something, you find out what it is, and you learn more about it. The problem with math is that there's so much technicality. I think of math and writing as similar, at least algebra. I mean, in writing, we have specific grammar. You know, we put a period at the end of a sentence. We put a capital at the beginning of a sentence. We capitalize I. We spell, you know, I before E except after C and in weird or whatever, you know, rule it is, you know. And algebra is the same, very exact, but it's not as concrete. You know, you use words every day, you know, you read, but math, you really have to work at. And so for me, I try to balance. I do projects, but I also realize that when kids get out of here and if they're going into a technical career, they have to know how to do that, you know, do all that grammar of math. You can't just do a project and sort of hope that they get it, you know, because if they're going to go to UC Davis, you know, they're expected to know certain things. And so I'm kind of torn by that. So I try to mix it up. I don't know if there's one right answer. I'll be honest with you. I've taught now for 30 years, and I don't know if there's one right way to teach. I think there's a bunch of different ways to teach, and some of them, the ways work for some people, and some of the ways work for other people. Mm-hmm. And you know, it might almost be better if there were, you know, I mean, maybe the idea of charter schools or something is good because you would have different kinds of emphases, you know, maybe you'd have some places have, you know, an arts-focused school or a technology-focused school. In a place like Laytonville, we have to do it all. We do the best we can, I guess.
I was just wondering, you know how some students really have what they call them for themselves a math block?
Yeah.
They really freak out, especially with algebra.
Yeah.
And I was lucky. I didn't have that at all. Math was really easy for me. And like it probably was for you, or you wouldn't have gone to college in math. And I just wonder, do you think that a lot of that math block comes from early experiences in school? And if so, is there a way to overcome the students that you get that are really freaked out by algebra and they know they're going to fail and they fail or don't do well?
You know, that's a really good question. I always tell the students when they first come to me, so they typically first would come to me in a pre-calculus class. And I have them write a math biography. But I always tell them a little bit about myself. And I didn't get what they were trying to teach us in math when I was in the second or third grade or whenever it was. When they were teaching us adding, I did not understand what they were talking about. I remember that specifically when we'd have to add, you know, 22 and 47 or whatever it was. And I'd make little marks on my desk and count them up. I think part of it's developmental, and I think that some people who don't get certain concepts at age 13 would probably get them at age 23 or 33. I also think that that early development has something to do with it, because for some reason I've always liked building. Building's my hobby. So I got geometry. I mean, I that's why I started scoring high on these tests when they give you, when you're a kid, you know, I score off the charts on the geometry part of it. And so I truly believe I've taught adults as well. I used to teach at Mendocino College for a while. And a lot of times people come and say, "Wow, I didn't think I could do it, but I understand. You must be a great teacher. And I'm saying, no, it's not me. It's you that's changed. You know, you've seen something of enough of life to know, number one, that it's that math is not necessarily completely abstract. There's some, you use it for some things. And at the same time, I just think it's a, your brain has made enough connections to be able to pull it together. I've had to work on writing as an adult. I was, like I said, a math type person, I guess, and I was not a good writer. I didn't like writing. I liked reading, but I did not like writing. But in trying to write songs made me start thinking about words, and then trying to express myself on a page, I realized I didn't know how to really do it. And so I focused on it and I worked on it. And that's another thing. I mean, it's a thing that you, that technical skills like writing or algebra or something requires you to sit down and work at it.
That's right.
It's not, doesn't just float down. And so I guess it's a combination of development, early, you know, experiences. And then something you said, Dan, about a kid coming into the class knowing that they were going to fail.
The more they tell themselves.
That's, if you know you're going to fail, then you're going to fail.
Yeah, you keep telling yourself that it's most likely going to happen. If you tell yourself, no, I got this, and you actually try to grasp the concept, there's a great chance you'll pass.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And sometimes you have to ask for help.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. There's nothing wrong with that.
No.
Well, I was thinking, because I've known a number of adults who went back to get their college degree and they had to take basic math again, like algebra and stuff, and they were really freaked out about it. And I realized that somewhere along the line, the difference with math, okay, with numbers, you have a number like 3, and then you learn that there's 3 oranges, and you get, okay, this is a symbol for these things. And then when you get to algebra, you have a symbol like A, and A equals 1, so you've made a symbol of a symbol. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that any teacher ever mentioned that to me, but somehow or other, I feel like it would have been easier for me. I really didn't have problems with math, like I said, but I think some students don't understand that now they're on this, you know, secondary level of symbolism.
Yeah.
And I also think that part of the reason that students don't understand why they would need algebra, and people say, oh, well, you might need it later in life. Well, you know, it's really a small number of people that actually need to be able to do algebraic calculations. On the other hand, it trains your mind to, you know, in the same way that symbolizing 3 oranges with this glyph, or I guess that's a glyph, and then making it 3-dimensional and saying A equals 3, that does something to the organization of your brain so that maybe you can think in a different way. What do you think about that?
Well, I definitely think that it adds to the organization of your brain. When you become a teacher, you have to study educational philosophy. And I was always struck by the idea that learners, little kids, being the greatest learners are the little kids. But they go through, everybody apparently goes through phases of concrete when you're talking about oranges and things. You know, that's why they have little kids, you're talking about, oh, if I have 3 apples and then I add 2 apples to it, how many apples do I have? Things like that. That's concrete. And then you go from the concrete to the semi-concrete, which would be writing the numbers on a paper. And you're still adding, you know, numbers. And then you go to the abstract, which would be algebraic concepts and all of the crazy notations that they have. And part of the problem, I think, for learners is that they don't all arrive at the semi-concrete, I didn't arrive at the semi-concrete at the same time when I was supposed to in the third grade or whatever grade that was. And a lot of students haven't arrived at the abstract at age 13 or whenever they're supposed to learn algebra.
In band? Well, this year I'm playing keyboard and I'm playing bass guitar, two things that I've actually never really done. Well, I've played keyboard before, but not like in a band before, just by myself. Also, I'm really enjoying the songs that we're doing this year, and I'm glad that I'm getting to experience new things. Also, the fun part is always getting up in front of people to show off. And I have to say, Mr. Hogan really knows his way with the guitar. Like, he's a really good guitar teacher, especially. And I feel like everyone in my band class is also trying to give it their best. And of course, sometimes we have those days where we're just not feeling it. And hey, that can happen to anybody. I mean, it's happened with Nirvana. But anyway, I'm enjoying band this year, and I'm going to miss it next year. I'm a senior.
You know, one of the best experiences I had of the Laytonville High School band was a few years ago at graduation, and the band broke into I Want to Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself. And it's still, I feel it. It was like so powerful. It was amazing. Not only were they so good, but what they were saying and feeling, you know, about Laytonville High School, that people are allowed to be themselves, but also this great funk, amazing song.
I remember when they performed that. That was when my cousin Cody was in band, too. My name is Tim Skaggs. I'm a senior at Laytonville High School, and I've been talking to my band teacher, Mr. Dennis Hogan. Rock on.
That's all for this month's edition of Youth Speaks Out.
Laytonville Healthy Start Coalition's Drug-Free Communities Project is proud to support this month's Youth Speaks Out. Our Environmental Prevention Strategies in the Community, also known as EPIC, is a project funded by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Through our organization and coalition, we are working towards reducing youth substance abuse through a variety of strategies in the Laytonville community. If you are interested in learning more about our efforts, please contact Laytonville Healthy Start at 707-984-8089 or email jama@laytonville.org.
Youth Speaks Out is produced and directed by Dan Roberts, who may be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490, or through the website www.youthspeaksout.net. There you can find out more information about the project or get addresses for contacting us, get a copy of a show, and listen to many hours of previous programs and streaming audio.
The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those on KZYX. They are the views of those who express them.
The link to automatically receive our podcast is available at our website, youthspeaksout.net.